Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Monday, May 13th. I'm going to explain how we're going to change the order of the agenda. The work session for House Bill 2787A will not be held today. We will reschedule that one. House Bill 2456A, we may be able to finish that today, but it's very likely we will carry over 2456A. We will not be doing the hearings in the order that they're printed on the agenda. We're doing 459, Senate Bill 459 first. Second will be Senate Bill 212, and third will be House Bill 3023A. There are quite a few people who have signed up for 3023A. We have a hard stop of around 9:45 and 9:50 when we have to stop. So those of you who have planned like 5 or 10 minute speeches, we're not going to have time for 5 or 10 minute speeches from everybody. Very often when it happens that we have 15 or 30 people, 2 or 3 pages of people who've signed up, we limit testimony to about 2 minutes each. So if you'd like to be thinking about how to limit your testimony to about 2 minutes each, that would be terrific. Otherwise, we may not be able to get to you today. We may be able to only read your written testimony that you've submitted, or consider other options for extending a hearing, but I don't know how likely that is at this point in this session also. So all of that is to say, if you have planned testimony and other people are saying the same thing you are, you might consider coming up with them and then just saying ditto, and then the other person could have 3 or 4 minutes to explain the issue more thoroughly. Just a little time for you to think about how that will work. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 459A.
Okay, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 459A is a bill that's making changes to auctioned income tax credits we have here in Oregon. What the changes are being made is, the first is it's decreasing the reserve bid amount in the auctions for these tax credits. Again, this is for the film and video and the opportunity grant auction tax credits. So it's decreasing that reserve bid amount from at least 95% of the total face value of the credit to 90%. And then it's also making requirements or changes to the timing of when these credits would be sold. So it's requiring the tax credit auctions, which are conducted by the Department of Revenue in cooperation with Film and Video and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, those auctions would be conducted no later than April 15th, following the December 31st of any tax year in which the credit is allowed. And these changes would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2019 and before January 1st, 2024.
Thank you. I'm calling all three people who've signed up to come up to the table. Tim Williams, Cindy Robert, Dave McDonald. And how interesting, OMPA seems to be setting up today right down the hall from us.
Yes.
What a coincidence.
Do you guys mind if I go first?
Oh, please.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. That's 16 private nonprofit colleges and universities in Oregon with about 35,000 students. In 2018, Senate Bill 1528, your tax credit and federal disconnect bill, that was very controversial, did have one part in it that was not controversial, and that was a tax credit auction added to help with the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is Oregon's largest needs-based grant program. More than 40,000 students receive Oregon Opportunity Grants every year, and only students with a family-adjusted gross income below $70,000 are allowed to participate. The maximum amount of the award for community colleges is $2,600, and for colleges and universities is $3,200. In 2017-19, legislative allocation to the OOG was $146 million. Allowing it to only meet the need of half of those students who were qualified to get the money financially. So we looked at doing a tax credit auction, very much like the very successful film and video tax credit auction, to help to fund the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Built the program, put it into your tax credit bill, and it succeeded. So what's the problem here? The problem is that, well, first of all, I should say that the tax credit auctions could not be more than $14 million. That's where they were capped for a fiscal year. And we reached that the very first auction year. This will be the second auction year, and we're hoping to have the same kind of success, which means that we have raised the Oregon Opportunity Grant by 20%. The problem is that with some new federal tax laws, the program isn't as attractive as it used to be. So Senator Haas thought of this in a way to shake things up, make things a little bit different, and it really helps. So operating under the assumption that the IRS rule becomes permanent and federal tax credit benefit mostly disappears, this bill makes the tax auction certificates more attractive by decreasing the reserve bid amount from 95% to credit of 90, from 95 down to 90%, and it makes it more valuable for state taxes, but not federal taxes. So that's the difference. We're trying to make it up in your state tax write-off because the federal tax write-off will be gone.
Thank you. I have some slides. Yep, great. Thanks. Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Tim Williams. I'm the executive director of Oregon Film, the state film and media office. The Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF, is a rebate program that we use to incentivize and retain and recruit film, TV, in and around production here in Oregon. It is currently capped at $14 million per year and is funded through the online sale of tax credits. Funding for the OPIF program is a way that allows us to have a multi-year program that has led to extensive economic output as measures in jobs and in-state spending, and a growing indigenous workforce now retaining year-round employment in what is primarily a freelance industry. Other specific indices of this successful program are small business growth, creative community development, and expanded opportunity. Historically, the program started out as a first-come, first-serve reservation system, and tax credits were sold at a flat 90% rate for the first 4 years. Then the minimum bid was adjusted to what can best be described as a blended 90% and 95% reservation and in-person sale for the next 3 years. The online auction program we now have with a 95% minimum bid came into existence in 2012 and has led to increasing participation for 6 straight years. With the adoption of the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, changes were made to the treatment of the state tax credits at the federal level. This was further clarified in an IRS notice in June of 2018 and an IRS proposed regulations on this issue of August 2018. This, coupled with increasing interest rates, have made the 95% minimum bid offer less valuable to potential buyer. In fact, this past year, we had to conduct 3 separate auctions and still were not able to sell out all of our tax-allocated tax credits. Since its inception in 2005, the OPIF program has accounted for more than $1.3 billion of tracked in-state spending and has provided us a consistent tool that we have used to retain and attract projects here in the state. More specifically, multi-year television series that are looking for several years of stability in order to account for multiple renewals of the series themselves. This is why a program that allows for stability and projection for more than 5 years is very important to us. Here are some examples of the economic impact of multi-year television series that were produced here in Oregon. We can see here 4 different TV series that have based themselves in Oregon over the last 10 years. Together, these 4 projects make up 22 different seasons of accounting for more than $500 million of in-state spending and affecting more than 1,000 jobs annually. In addition, each of these productions interacted with hundreds of small businesses and allowing for a steadily broadening landscape for small businesses servicing the interactive and TV communities. Because of the historic consistency in our programs, we have not only competed well with more than 30 other states that have similar program or larger programs, retaining repeat business from well-established companies, we've also attracted new and emerging content companies like Netflix and Hulu. Without stable and consistent funding for the OPIF program, attracting and retaining these types of multi-year productions and companies would be much more difficult. Just as some background, there are 2 main incentive programs we use for economic development, the OPIF program I just described and the Greenlight Labor Rebate Program. Together, these programs offer up to a 16% return of in-state payrolled labor and 20% of goods and services bought or rented from Oregon businesses. This rebate is paid out only after the production has completed its spending, and it is confirmed via audit. There are two smaller funds we also use as part of the larger OPIF system that focus on smaller, locally produced projects, as well as regional production work. These programs are called IOPIF and ROPIF, respectively. These programs allow us to balance the work produced in Oregon between product that is being recruited into the state just as much as there are products that are developed in creative producers here in the state. This past fiscal year has seen the upward trend in tracked jobs, number of projects, and overall in-state spending, yielding our highest numbers to date in terms of number of projects and jobs. It's important to note that this is a freelance industry by choice and by design, and that these jobs are often shared over multiple projects, while it is also important to note that each of these projects can create new opportunities for well-paying living wage jobs with benefits, but also a new set of entry-level positions that often present opportunity to younger, less experienced workforce in the industry. Job creation, retention, and growth has also been positively affected by the consistency of our programs. This industry has seen steady job growth due to productions now being produced in the state over a wider part of the calendar year. One of the goals of our office is to continue this trend while working with the tools we have to augment it. In addition, small businesses have also both grown and started over the course of OPIS program's existence. These are businesses that not only provide equipment and materials such as cameras, lights, and trucks, but also companies that were not specifically created as motion picture and video businesses, such as caterers, clothing stores, hardware stores, cabling companies, taxis, rental cars, hotels, and many, many others. In particular, we've seen encouraging growth in the animation industry, more specifically the stop motion animation industry, where we have three feature-length jobs here in the state at the moment, and a fourth and possibly a fifth still on the way. The OPIF program has been a vital tool in us retaining these new locally produced multi-year animation projects and stopping their production from going overseas to places such as London. Further to this, a new report in the Arts and Educational Production Satellite Account produced by the NEA also shows that Oregon has one of the nation's fastest growing arts and cultural sectors. Led by broadcasting and motion pictures and architectural services, Oregon's arts and cultural sector is a nationally recognized growing economic engine. We've also recently introduced a regional fund, or ROPIF, which has financially encouraged productions to move their production spending to various parts of the state. This brings spending to other regions of Oregon, while it also makes it easier for productions to photograph and utilize the many, many different landscapes and locations this state has to offer. For the fiscal year 2017-2018, 11 projects used this program to move some or all of their production to areas around the state. All these projects are utilizing Oregon crews, purchasing from local vendors, eating at local restaurants, and staying at local hotels. This map shows tracked hotel and accommodation spending throughout the state by projects utilizing this program over the last 2 years. And through an ongoing partnership with Travel Oregon, we continue to utilize these projects as a wide audience platform to augment the marketing of the entire state for tourism. Without clear certainty, our ability to market and sell all of these tax credits, which have been made available to this program, will make it more difficult for us to retain and recruit one-off or multi-year projects representing millions of dollars of in-state spending and thousands of jobs, not to mention marketing for the state as a whole. In addition to the continued growth of the industry here in Oregon, may be halted or reversed if further uncertainty is brought to our OPIF program. SB 459 helps us try to get out in front of that problem. It's also important to note that the reduction of the minimum bid does not mean that all of these credits will automatically be sold at 90%. In fact, the history of the program tells us they won't be. The average winning bids at auction are always higher than the minimum reserve bid. But the auction for the minimum reserve bid allows us to proactively react to a changing marketplace while retaining the growth potential for a program that has served us well for many decades. SB 459 gives us the ability to also physically sell the credits closer to tax day the following calendar year, thereby allowing us to adjust the timing in order to increase the value to the potential buyer. I thank you very much for your time, and I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. McDonald.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dave McDonald. I'm Associate Vice President of Western Oregon University. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Finley, Vice Chair Marsh, Oregon, like most other states in the country, faces an affordability crisis that is affecting our students at the two-year, four-year public and four-year private institutions. This crisis is going to have a generational impact for our students. It is going to prevent students and their families from being able to pursue a college education that will lead to better lifetime earnings, better lifetime health, and membership in our society. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is the state's only grant program available to students attending a four-year public or private institution. The Oregon Promise has done wonders at the two-year institution, and in combined with the Oregon Opportunity Grant, provides an incredible scaffolding for students to help afford college at their two-year institutions. This particular initiative adds $14 million, not a lot of money to a $140 million venture. I want to give you a sense of scale. Our neighbors to the north, Washington, just passed the Workforce Education Investment Act, which is estimated to provide up to $1 billion into their opportunity grant equivalent in a manner that will allow students who have or come from a family income of $50,000, roughly the Oregon's median family income, to go to a community college or university free of charge with no waiting lists. In Oregon, we turn away students who are eligible but apply too late. Those students who are often turned away are first-generation students, students who really are the least equipped to understand the process and procedures that are accompanying going for financial aid, especially in limited resources. This particular bill doesn't address the way Washington does, but it's a step in the right direction. It's a step that will help families and a step that, obviously, the data shows, has had some popularity in the investment world. The universities very much support this initiative and ask that you support it as well, and also look at this as a first step to really trying to invest formally and thoughtfully into our affordability crisis in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you all. We have no additional testimony for this morning on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing. On Senate Bill 459A, I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 212A. Yes. Do you want to start out?
Yeah, sure. Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 212A is a bill that's making changes in how or relating to Oregon's connection to the definition of federal taxable income and how Oregon interacts with the Internal Revenue Code at the federal level. And there's two changes being made in this bill. The first one has to do with the deduction related to gambling losses, and then the second component is allowing a subtraction here in Oregon related to tuition and fees. So the first part, again, is the deduction exists right now in federal law, and through Oregon's connection, Oregon has this deduction as well. It's an itemized deduction related to losses from wagering transactions, which is generally called referred to as gambling losses. So the itemized deduction allows a taxpayer to deduct their gambling losses up to the amount of their gambling winnings in the tax year. So the bill, starting with tax years 2019 forward, would disallow that deduction here in Oregon of the gambling losses. The second piece is allowing a subtraction from taxable income here in Oregon related to the tuition and fees deduction that did exist in federal Internal Revenue Code statute. It has since expired at the federal level, but the statute, the IRC statute, still exists. What the change in 212 is doing is utilizing that language at the federal level to allow the tuition and fee subtraction here in Oregon per the parameters at the federal level, but allowing it at 23% of that amount you'd otherwise calculate for the federal subtraction. So again, this subtraction was one that Oregon had through our connection to federal statute, but since the federal statute has since sunset, Oregon no longer has this above-the-line deduction either, and that's where Senate Bill 212 comes in and puts that deduction back in place, makes it a subtraction, and allows it at 23% of the total amount. And again, that's part of the offsetting costs that were contained in the revenue impact of these two component pieces.
Thank you. Senator Hass.
Good morning, Vice Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Findley, Chair Nathanson, familiar faces and the fellow revenuers. My name is Mark Hass, Senate District 14, Beaverton, Washington County. I come here today in support of Senate Bill 212. I won't read you the testimony that I submitted, even though I know legislators love it when people do that. I guess I would start off by saying a lot of people in Oregon would be surprised to know that our state tax code allows gambling losses to be written off on their state taxes. And our committee in the Senate was surprised, too, during the interim when we started looking at this whole issue of how to disconnect or reconnect and what other states do. It turns out Oregon is kind of an outlier in this issue. But as we went through some of these, and I think you've experienced with this gambling provision, this one looked extreme. And so, too, did it look extreme, the idea that the federal government ended the tuition deduction. So we thought it made sense for us to tie these two together because gambling, the deduction has to be less than winnings. It is nonetheless a subsidy. And this subsidy costs the Oregon Treasury $11 million a biennium. This is twice the cost of our first-time home buyer program. It's twice the cost of the political contribution tax credit, which you all know about. And it's about the same as what we spend to help rural medical providers. And we recently decided that was more than we can afford. And the interesting thing is, nobody in Oregon ever thought this gambling subsidy was a good idea. It was passed by policymakers in Washington, D.C., but because we're tied to the federal tax code, it becomes part of our state tax code as well. And inexplicably, when Congress voted to extend this tax break for gamblers in 2017, as I mentioned, they also let expire tax break to help college students. Again, nobody in Oregon made that decision. It was because of our federal connection to federal tax law. So what this bill does is really pretty simple. As Kyle explained, it disconnects Oregon from the gambler subsidy, and it adds back the tuition deduction for students or their parents. I think these two changes are a much better reflection of our values as Oregonians. Most Oregonians want to help college students, and I think most Oregonians are okay with gambling. They just don't think they should be subsidizing them. The tuition deduction will provide a modest savings of about $82 a year for students or parents earning less than $80,000. And to a working, maybe part-time college student, this is a couple of textbooks, maybe a week of groceries. Gamblers, they still get their federal tax break, but not the $11 million in assistance from the state of Oregon. Congress passed hundreds of bills in 2017, and I don't want you to think that just because we are picking out these two bills, we're looking at all of these, but these two provisions did rise to the top when our Senate Interim Committee looked at the larger issue of automatically connecting to every tax policy made by Congress. Most of the time, this connection works, but increasingly, federal tax policies are out of step with Oregon values. And I think a larger issue for all of us on the Revenue Committee is whether we should change from this reconnect system and one where we move to what most states are doing and we sort of opt in to federal changes instead of this situation where we have to pass a state law quite literally every time we want to opt out. There was no opposition presented to the committee on Senate Bill 212. This bill was amended on the advice of LC to another because of a relating clause issue, but in its earlier version, Senate Bill 194, there was no opposition publicly either in the committee. But you will hear pushback. The tribal casinos don't like this, and the CPAs don't like this. I have a very good and long record of supporting the tribes and helping them in public policies, but on this one, we will agree to disagree. They don't like this because of, you know, for obvious reasons. The tribes don't pay state taxes in Oregon, and I find it an incongruity here that they would expect state taxpayers to subsidize their customers. So with the CPAs, they're not so much with the policy, as you'll hear, but they want to keep things simple and easy for tax preparation purposes, which I totally understand. But every once in a while, when there's an extreme, you have to make a change. And as I've told them before, our job here is not to make life easy for CPAs, it's to make life better for Oregonians. So in the context of a $23 billion budget, there's not a lot of money here, but to me, there's a larger principle. Oregonians should decide their own tax policy and not be forced to live under decisions made by people outside of our state in Washington, D.C. Thank you. Appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for Senator Hess? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to hear from Dave McDonald and Bauer?
I think that was Bauer. Yeah.
Jim, maybe Bauer, Oregon Alliance.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm here for the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. I only take 2 minutes to describe why we got involved with this bill with Senator Haas, but I do want to say...
I'm going to cross off Jim's name, and you're here.
I'm sorry,
Jim.
Yes.
Yes, got it.
Sorry about that. I don't look like Jim today, do I? Thank you. I want to point out really quickly as we start here that this is the second bill that you've heard so far that somehow affect the ability of low-income students to go to college in Oregon. And I'm really proud of the fact that the private universities and the public universities, Dave and I have worked on this together from the onset to try to get more money to the low-income students in Oregon to go to college, and I'm proud of that work. Senate Bill 212 returns to Oregon taxpayers a subtraction for qualified tuition and fees that has been taken away from low-income taxpayers. The federal deduction for higher education tuition and fees hasn't been extended for tax years since 2017, meaning the deduction, the subtraction of the state gets taken away when the deduction gets taken away at the federal level. In prior years, taxpayers making less than $65,000 were able to subtract up to $4,000 for their higher education expenses. In 2017, the median family income in Oregon was just $73,000. That's $689 lower than the median U.S. family income. So this was a valuable federal deduction that now we need to make up at the state level. The state of Oregon and its institutions of higher education have committed themselves to access for students and have placed affordability at the forefront. The Alliance is proud to join in this effort. 21% of our students are first generation, 28% receive Pell Grants, 85% receive institutional financing, averaging $28,000 per year per student, and 28% of our students graduate with zero debt. Thank you for your efforts to help us help Oregonians go to college.
For the record, my name is Dave McDonald, Western Oregon University. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Finley, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. I want to start by referencing back to something Senator Haas said. This is a bill that is better for Oregonians. It is as simple as that. This bill helps us in a minute but meaningful way further our efforts to make college a little more affordable for some Oregonians. Clearly, the income restrictions on this means that the upper income families won't benefit, but they didn't benefit from the federal piece either. This is something that really helps our middle income and lower income families reduce some of the cost of education. Now, the senator mentioned $82 as, you know, the amount that some families would receive. That may seem insignificant. I cannot tell you the number of times I've had a student in my office who has a $100 obstacle preventing them from staying registered in school. For a student who is on a threadbare budget, $82 can make the difference between staying in school and not. It's more than the cost of a textbook. It, in many cases, is the cost of going to college. So the dollar amount, $82, should be higher. We should be at a higher threshold. We should be at a higher amount. But obviously, to make this budget neutral, revenue neutral, those are the compromises that need to be made in this legislation. Fully support this. We appreciate working with the independent colleges on this. We think this is something that's good for Oregon and good for Oregon students. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We will have two more panels of testimony on this bill before we move to the next bill. First, Justin Martin, Chris Mercier, Stan Dillon.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I am also a tribal member. I would like to recognize our tribal chairwoman, Cheryl Kennedy, who is also here with us today. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. We are here, unfortunately, in opposition of Senate Bill 212. And we want to make it known we have no problems with the higher education piece, but we do have a problem with the gambling loss deduction. Over 23 years ago, when I was hired by the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, we came into a legislative environment in which there were 38 bills that could have potentially affected Indian Country. Of those 38 bills, 19 of those would have closed our doors. So what did we do? Collectively, as tribes throughout Oregon, we worked on a program. We worked on a program that opened lines of communication with the legislature, opened lines of education. How can we work cooperatively together to make a difference in Oregon? And just in 4 short years with that program, we went from seeing that 19 pieces of potentially devastating legislation move to 6 pieces of legislation that were positive. Things like dealing with illegally held archaeological objects, things dealing with deletion of squaw language from Oregon geographic names, things like Senate Bill 770, of which you heard from Senator Hass, who has been a true champion of Indian Country. He was around when that passed in 2001, creating a real communication between tribal agencies and state agencies. Over the course of that 20 years, we have seen many positive things in this legislative body, things like Indian child welfare actions, things like tribal police, and being able to have tribal police officers work as peace officers around the state, negotiations with the tribal gaming section in dealing with budgets and how we deal with enforcement throughout Oregon. So we're very proud of the record that Oregon has. Unfortunately, with Senate Bill 194, which has been put into Senate Bill 212, we didn't have any of that communication. I was not approached in the interim about how this may affect Indian Country. None of my colleagues were approached on how this may affect Indian Country. And the reality is this has a big impact on our customers. You will hear from Chris Mercier, who is tribal council member for Grand Ronde and the vice chair of the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance. And then you'll hear specifically from Stan Dillon, who's the general manager of Spirit Mountain Casino. But this has a very sharp impact on Indian Country. We would love to work with the legislature to come up with an answer. We just cannot support this because it hits directly our customers. And the reality is the money from those customers goes towards us being able to provide essential governmental services in the same areas that the state does. That's health, that's education, that's housing, that's elder care. We need those dollars to continue to do what we do in rural parts of Oregon. As many of you know, 3 of the tribes, I believe, are either the number 1 or number 2 employers within their counties. We are the economic drivers in rural Oregon. These dollars are absolutely critical for us to maintain those level of services and continue on. We know, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that you will look closely at this so we can continue this positive government-to-government relationship that makes Oregon so unique within the United States. So thank you very much. Again, we are here in opposition to Senate Bill 212. We look forward to hopefully that being separated out. And as we move forward, we look to continued communication that benefits us all. Thank you.
Before the next person speaks, I want to do a time check with everybody. We have, after this panel, 3 additional people on this bill, and then 2 pages of people signed up to testify on the next bill. I want to try to be fair and provide at least as much time for the opponents as for those who spoke in favor. I'd like to conclude this part of the hearing by 9:20.
Okay. That's fine. So, good morning. My name's Chris Mercier. As Justin stated, I'm the vice chair for the Grand Ronde Tribe, and I'm also the vice chair for the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance. And I'm here primarily to speak on behalf of the OTGA. We are very concerned about the passage of Senate Bill 212A in the Oregon Senate. We believe that this legislation will have a larger impact on Oregon tribes and the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue considered prior to Senate Bill 194 being gutted and stuffed into 212A, a tax bill relating to education costs. The OTGA requests that the legislature slow down and take a look at what the true impacts of this Senate bill will be on our casino patrons and ultimately our Oregon tribes. Taxing a player's winnings without crediting his or her losses will drastically increase how much a player is out of pocket. This will reduce the can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay. This will reduce the players' future play and consequently tribal revenue. The impact on tribal communities will be significant. Just a small factoid that I insert in here. It may surprise people, but maybe not. So about 80% of our revenue at Spirit Mountain comes from about 20% of our patrons. So the revenue tends to be concentrated into a few. The results of this legislation are not as black and white as what was messaged during the floor debate. Through players, clubs, tribal casinos track information for our customers. These reports show that a significant tax liability will be shouldered by our players. We were not consulted or asked to share any of this information with the legislature while the Senate bill was being considered in committee. The Senate's actions on Senate Bill 194 and 212A violates, we believe, the government-to-government relationship between tribes and the state. Tribes were not consulted during the interim, nor did the chairman of the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue or the Legislative Revenue Office ask us about potential impacts during the 2019 legislative session. Tribal representatives attended the hearing on Senate Bill 194 and expressed their opposition to the committee chairman, but unfortunately, our concerns were ignored. We are hopeful that you, as a champion of the government-to-government process, will listen and look closely at our concerns before moving forward and consider alternative ways to Senate Bill 194 and 212A. We see Senate Bill 212A as essentially a pass-through tax that takes revenue away from tribes, affecting tribes' ability to provide essential governmental services. All of Oregon's tribes continue working towards self-sufficiency, including funding such programs as healthcare, housing, education, natural and cultural resources, and public safety. Tribal gaming revenue is a key component of Oregon's rural economy. And just in closing, I would urge everyone to go on to the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance's website, which you can, it's otga.net. And over the past decade plus, we've been producing really detailed reports about the impacts of tribal gaming on Oregon's economy. And I think you'll find it a goldmine of information. So with that, I thank you for your time this morning.
I'm going to ask our Legislative Revenue Office to start using a timer of 2 minutes, because I see there's at least one question. I feel a commitment to hear everybody, but if something's already been said, you don't need to say the whole thing. Representative Finlan, you had a question.
I do have a question. Your comments that you provided testimony in the Senate against Senate Bill 194, yet Senator Hass talked about no opposition discussed during Senate Bill 212's passage of committee. I'm wondering, what did you provide testimony on this bill in the Senate in opposition?
And keep it a very short answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Finley, we attended the hearing, which was one of the first days of session. We then went and had closed door meetings with Senator Hass and others within the Senate, but we did not formally oppose at that time because it was a surprise to us. So out of curiosity, we attended, and then we came up with our position, shared that with the sponsor of the bill and the committee and the Senate as well.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I will try to just, instead of reading my three pages, I'll just try to condense it. Basically, what we're seeing is the nine Indian tribes of Oregon respectfully challenge the proposed legislation, as the analysis shows the impact will disproportionately burden the nine tribes. The Spirit Mountain represents, out of the 7,600 active games that the tribes have, Spirit Mountain represents 23% of that, with 1,750 machines. The Oregon Lottery has 11,750 games. Combined together, there's 19,350 active games out there today. Spirit Mountain only represents 9% of those games. But even with that, what is shown by the state estimates on the 2019 of $5.7 million in revenue, the fact is, 2018, Spirit Mountain reported $56.2 million in gaming. So therefore, if we only represent 9% and we alone represent what the state is showing, that shows that we're not revenue neutral. So I don't know where the numbers came from, but if we only represent 9% of that, that also does not include those who play up at Lonnie, the people who play in Las Vegas, that play in Reno. So there's a lot of games and there's a lot of other revenue that too would offset that. The other part of this is the fact that, as has been reiterated, the 80-20 rule, the biggest players that come to our types of casinos that we rely on for 80% of revenue, it will be devastating. A player that actually comes in maybe $10,000, $12,000, hits multiple jackpot pays. They're just pays, and they play throughout the year, totaling at the end, what did they actually win or lose? It's not a, if you didn't do that, you could have people paying as much as $80,000 in taxes, which would be, I have exactly a play that shows that, where there'd be individuals to be taxed as high as 600% based on eliminating those jackpots because they didn't win. They actually lost for the year. So
we would be happy to have a copy of your written testimony so that we can see the complete letter.
Thank you.
You just leave it with the staff over here.
Great.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. Just very quickly, am I correct in understanding that this federal deduction was just initiated with the federal tax reforms of 2017?
Repeat that for me.
Am I correct in understanding that the federal tax deduction was just initiated with federal tax reform 2017?
This has been going for many years. I've been in this business for 40 years. It goes back as far as I can remember that they've always allowed the deductions. You would always, before computers, they had to write down and do little charts, but it has always been a part of the federal because they know that you're not actually winning. Just because you win a little jackpot throughout the year doesn't mean a player at the end of the year will have won. And I think that's kind of obvious when the Oregon Lottery takes in about $1 billion a year that players are not winning all these jackpots. The money cycles through the system, and at the end of the year, you say, did they win or did they lose so they could pay their taxes? In this case, by taxing every little hit throughout the year, which are just taxable wins that are calculated, the taxes would be sometimes outrageous. If a player's lucky and they're playing on our money, they just keep playing for the year. So this one instance, this one gentleman was probably in about $12,000, $13,000. He hit $800,000 worth of little jackpots throughout a year. He plays 2 to 3 times a week, so he plays hundreds of times throughout the year. At the end of the year, he would owe $80,000 in taxes, even though he lost $13,000. So he now would lose $93,000. So it would be a true disincentive to play. Why or how could you play if every little tiny hit you hit through the year that you're just cycling back to the machine, which is a part of a cycle? For instance, a $5 machine that has 28 pays, number 14 would be a taxable event, but it doesn't mean he hit a jackpot.
Your testimony. Next, we will hear from Katie Powell, Steve.
I can't tell if that's hard.
And Michael Mason. Please begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Katie Powell. I am a member of the Taxation Committee of the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants, the OSCPA. I'm a certified public accountant and a tax shareholder with a local public accounting firm in Portland, Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about Senate Bill 212. On behalf of the nearly 4,400 members of the OSCPA, I respectfully testify in opposition to this bill. The issue with this bill is not limited to the specific subject matter. Frankly, few of my clients would be impacted by the two very distinct provisions in this bill. Rather, the OSCPA's overarching concern is that this bill disconnects from the federal tax code. And in doing so, this bill advances the concept that disconnecting from federal tax statute is a simple course of action with little consequence. The lack of conformity between state and federal tax code is a significant concern. Disconnecting creates state tax complexity. The added complexity negatively impacts taxpayers and tax advisors alike. This creates additional challenges with respect to tax planning, tax compliance, record keeping, and oversight. The lack of conformity requires additional time for taxpayers and advisors to gain an understanding of the state differences and to properly comply with the requirements. And this additional time can result in increased compliance costs, whether through tax preparation fees or the purchase of tax software not previously needed to comply. Complexity also creates potential impacts for the Oregon Department of Revenue, as the more complex the process of understanding the differences between federal and state taxes, the higher the risk of unintended noncompliance or errors by taxpayers who may or may not be using the expertise of tax advisors. Errors add to the volume of tax notices and tax returns needing corrections. Supporting conformity and not disconnecting from various federal statutes and provisions is in the best interest of taxpayers. This helps taxpayers understand that federal tax law changes impact their Oregon tax compliance and obligations as well. From the big picture perspective, we're more than a year into the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and taxpayers and advisors. Are still trying to understand this legislation as it continues to evolve. And without the reconnect, it makes this more complex for taxpayers to understand and creates greater compliance burden.
If you add another comma, you can add another phrase if you need to.
Well, it's important to note, I think, that the timing of the legislative sessions in Oregon creates additional uncertainty for taxpayers with any provisions that maybe may continue to evolve at the federal level as new pronouncements come out.
Thank you. And is your letter included here? Is it the one submitted by Rob Douglas?
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the House Revenue Committee. My name is Michael Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon and the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians. I'm going to speak to the Siletz concerns first, though they're very similar. Again, the tribes were not consulted, and I wasn't consulted. And I think you recognize that, you know, my face is, it's unusual to see my face in this committee. We're loath to undertake opposition to tax measures. This is fundamentally your decision, how you fund the many services that you provide. But in this instance, for the Siletz tribe, which uses every dollar that they get from gaming at Chinook for essential services, this will have an impact estimated at around $1 million. Now, they're still working on the impact of this. This is not something that I mean, this is somewhat of a surprise to have this go in this direction, because it certainly, they are the second largest employer in Lincoln County. They still have a lot of members in poverty and a lot of needs similar to what Justin Martin talked about. If I may talk for a moment about the Warm Springs situation, some of you have heard from me about the existential crisis involving water and sewer at Warm Springs, where they now have the EPA saying that they have committed a Safe Drinking Water Act violation and they need to totally replace their water plant, their drinking water plant, to the tune of $37 million. This is not a time to take away from tribal revenue, as they believe will occur. With this, again, we're happy to work with folks on solutions, but we sincerely hope that the provision of Senate Bill 212 regarding the wagering loss tax deduction will be deleted. Thank you for your time and opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. And there is a question.
Oh. I again have my very same, almost real small question. Where were you during the Senate hearing on this committee meeting on this bill? I mean, they thought it was a slam dunk. How come you guys didn't provide testimony that says we don't like this bill?
Well, I can say from, Chair Nathanson and Representative Finley, this is a process, and I've said this to many people over the years, the most difficult thing about representing tribes in this building is that their process is completely the opposite. It is so deliberative that it would take them several years to get to this decision, I think. In the case of the Warm Springs, they were in the middle of an election, which took place, tribal council election, which took place on April 4th. It's a very difficult time for them to focus on anything but what's going on the res. So that's part of it. But it's also that there wasn't a discussion. We normally have a lengthy discussion about impacts on tribes. And I think there was a misunderstanding about how much impact this would have on tribes.
From my perspective, I would say, Chair Nathanson and Representative Finley, that it fell during tax season for us as well. And in addition to that, the OSCPA has a long history of serving in an informative capacity before the legislature rather than in an opposing position. And so it's more in our nature to inform than to oppose.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. There was someone else signed up to testify. I'm sorry, I'm unable to read the last name. The first name is Steve. Is there someone named Steve here to testify on this bill? That concludes our testimony. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 212A. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3023A.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3023A, we do have a dash A14 amendment as well up in OLIS. And the underlying measure, and I'll get to the amendment in just a second, is it's requiring a transportation network company to obtain a license from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Transportation network company, this is in the background of the SMS as well, but these are generally, that term is defined within the bill, but it's generally the type of companies that you may have heard of would be Uber and Lyft are the type of companies that would represent what a transportation network company is. But again, there are initial requirements related to the transportation network company and the drivers that operate for it. Provisions related, really specific to one of the reasons it's probably in this committee, has to do with there are initial and annual licensing fees and then fees related to the number of I guess there's a few different fees related to the number of rides that are used by the company or by customers of the company. There are general administrative requirements for the Oregon Department of Transportation and also specifications on how this interacts with local governments and ability of local governments to establish fees as well. And then it become operative on January 1st, 2020. The dash A14 does modify some terms and make some changes related to the time periods, pushing them all to 7 years. It does require vehicle inspections and driver backgrounds to be conducted annually as well. And then the last thing I'd highlight from the A14 is establishing for the fees from the Oregon Department of Transportation, it would allow ODOT to begin adjusting those fees for inflation beginning in 2022, and then they'd be adjusted each even-numbered year thereafter.
Thank you. We have 26 people signed up to testify and two legislators here. I have no idea how long the legislators plan for presenting testimony, so after that, I'll try to figure out how many people for public testimony we can get through today before our ending time. I will focus on inviting people who live more than 100 miles away or who represent at least one of an entity. When I see several people signed up representing the same entity, I'm going to try to get at least one of you in today. We will very likely continue the public hearing tomorrow for anyone who is able to come back. Representative McLean, Representative Williams.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan McLean, and I'm from House District 29. I really appreciate your consideration of House Bill 30. 30- 23A, which establishes a statewide safety permitting framework so that all Oregonians can have access to ride sharing. Now more than ever, communities throughout Oregon are holding and hoping and looking for access to benefits of ride sharing. Reliable, efficient, and affordable transportation options, safe rides home, helping to reduce DUIs, flexible earning opportunities for drivers, and Oregon is currently one of the only states without a statewide framework for regulations of TNCs, and only a few cities in Oregon have ride sharing. This creates a patchwork quilt of different regulations and very inconsistent requirements that make it difficult for drivers to operate across Oregon and confusing for passengers as they're trying to plan for rides. The effort to create a statewide ride sharing legislation has been in the making for years. I've been working on this since, basically 2015. There have been many stakeholders that have been involved along the way, and it's supported by communities across the state, both urban and rural, with legislators from both chambers on both sides of the aisle. Statewide legislation is a pathway toward providing consumers, drivers, and visitors the insurance and assurance of consistently share experience. A statewide framework like House Bill 3023A creates equity across the state in rural and urban communities in small and large cities. Not every community will have the same needs, and not every city will have the capacity or the desire to individually work with TNCs to create those regulations. As our transportation system evolves, new technologies, platforms, and highly autonomous vehicles cross over and intersect with our TNCs, and new federal requirements will make it necessary to have a statewide framework. As technology progresses, it is important that we do not delay in creating the statewide system to ensure equal access and consistent regulation. I believe it's imperative for the state government to set the licensing, insurance safety, background check requirements for TNCs in order to maintain a seamless and well-regulated system. Drivers and passengers can move freely. However, we have maintained in House Bill 3023A the ability for cities and localities to enter into agreements with ODOT for local regulation and enforcement of the use of the curb, congestion, data sharing, and other issues. Relating to the evolution of the transportation system, there really are increasing complicated interjurisdictional problems, like congestion, which we heard all around the state. Congestion can impact more than one city, more than one county, and more than one jurisdiction. So the best opportunity to address it is using the state perspective. That being said, House Bill 3023A allows localities the ability to opt into IGAs with ODOT to handle regulation of their streets and to enter into agreements with companies for data sharing. House Bill 3023 is focused on a few areas of regulation: insurance, vehicle safety, driver background checks, records and data, and accessibility and equity. We also have a Dash 14 amendment, which is responsive to the feedback that we've gotten, and it was created in very close partnership with ODOT to ensure that the agency has what it needs to appropriately regulate TNCs. Retention, annual inspection and background checks, ODOT approved driver education, maximums of driving time, data reporting and sharing, state, local, and enforcement agreements, accessibility, EV infrastructure collaboration. We're still working on the wording for two amendments, making sure that wave rides are not subject to dynamic surge pricing, giving ODOT the authority to inspect records without consulting TNCs on the method. In addition to establishing a robust statewide licensing regulatory program, House Bill 3023A includes an important funding mechanism to support the transition to electric vehicles and help to reach our carbon reduction goals. As I'm sure you know, our transportation sector accounts for 40% of all the carbon emissions. Oregon has been a leader in expanding the network for EV charging stations to support EV car ownership. However, our federal funding is going away, and the Oregon Coast Electric Highway is in need of critical updates. House Bill 3023A adds a pre-ride and per-ride fee on the rideshare trips to fill that federal gap of funding and improve our EV infrastructure. I want to thank you again for consideration of House Bill 3023A. I think it's critical that we take this step this session to ensure equal and consistent access across Oregon for new mobility opportunities. House Bill 3023A was a very collaborative effort and creates a statewide framework that is neither the strongest nor the weakest in the nation, but rather it seeks to meet the unique needs of Oregon. And I'm happy to answer any questions. And I do want to make sure that you know that there are at least three items on OLIS that summarize the things that I said today and specifically go through dash 14 amendments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chairs Marsh and Finley. My name is Anna Williams, House Representative for House District 52. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about House Bill 3023A. I'm a little bit biased, but I think House District 52 is the best district in Oregon. we have an abundance of natural resources as well as breweries and wineries. People come from all over the state and the nation to visit our community. They contribute a lot to our local community, but they also contribute to a drinking and driving problem that our law enforcement isn't able to address due to other funding issues in our community. So I would love to see this bill pass because I personally have witnessed impaired driving. I've seen people hit by impaired drivers in our downtown. This frightens me, and I think ride-sharing services would be well utilized in our community. And of course, the access to public transportation for tourists is not the only issue I think this bill would help address. We also struggle with adequate and accessible public transportation for older adults and people with disabilities. They struggle to get to doctor's appointments, to the school, to pharmacies, things like that, basic needs. And we've been hearing from the disability community and the caregivers in our community that this would really help, especially the WAVE measures that Susan addressed in her testimony. I think this would help communities across the state, people who use public transportation who are blind, other resources like that who struggle to get on the bus system that we have in our rural parts of the state. My one caveat is that the bill seems to imply that drivers for transportation network companies are presumed to be independent contractors rather than employees. I don't necessarily love seeing that in the policy itself, so I'm just pointing that out and hoping that we can leave that decision out of our state policy. Happy to talk to you more about how this would be a huge benefit for rural communities. If anyone has any questions, I know you have a lot of testimony to get to, so I will skip the rest of what I had to say, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions, or shall we move to the next panel? Thank you for being here. Next, I'd like to call I'm going to hope to get through at least two, maybe three panels. Please limit your comments to 2 minutes each, but if you're in the middle of the sentence, I may let you finish. Caleb Weaver, Brian Hockaday, and Rose Feliciano. After that, we will hear from Nicole Sharon, Darren Campbell, and Tom Chamberlain.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and committee members. My name is Brian Hockaday. I am the Public Policy Manager for Lyft. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of HB 3023A and the Dash 14 Amendment. We appreciate the leadership of Representative McClain. And after three legislative sessions and much discussion and collaboration with a broad array of stakeholders, it's time we establish consistent statewide rules and safety standards so all Oregon communities can enjoy the benefits of ride sharing, just as the residents and visitors to Portland, Eugene, and the few other Oregon cities where ride share is available. Statewide legislation is a path towards giving more Oregonians, consumers, drivers, and visitors the assurance of a consistently safe rideshare experience. We believe that our transportation system can be more efficient, and we are committed to working with local and state planners and policymakers to tackle big challenges, including congestion and climate change. In fact, last spring, Lyft announced a commitment to being carbon neutral through offsets. And recently, we rolled out a new program called Green Mode in Portland, where Portlanders can actually choose to request a ride from hybrid and electric vehicles. We believe that our transportation system can continue to be improved and become more efficient. And HB 3023A, along with the Dash 14 amendments, incorporates the feedback and reflects the priorities that we have heard from many stakeholders, including Oregon cities. And it includes things like balancing statewide licensing with local enforcement. Local jurisdictions retain local enforcement of curb and traffic management and are granted explicit authority to conduct field enforcement actions and manage local enforcement programs through an IGA with ODOT. These are funded by a per-ride fee established by ODOT and intended to fully recover the cost of any local enforcement program. Additionally, the bill, along with the Dash 14 amendments, establishes robust reporting requirements and auditing oversight. It includes local data sharing agreements and ODOT-approved driver training. As cities and communities in Oregon continue to grow, Lyft is committed to providing Lyft and providing safe and reliable and affordable rides for more Oregonians. We know Oregonians across the state widely support a statewide framework, and just as a vast majority of other states have done, it's time we get in place a statewide framework that works for Oregon. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Caleb Weaver, and I oversee public affairs for Uber across 11 state region in the Western U.S. At Uber, we are working to use technology to remove barriers to transportation and provide opportunity. Here in Oregon, that technology has helped drivers provide millions of rides to hundreds of thousands of people in those cities where our app is available. And Oregon drivers have collectively earned millions of dollars a year working entirely on their own schedule. We are only a 10-year-old company, but people in hundreds of cities around the world now expect to have access to reliable, affordable, convenient transportation just about any time of the day without owning their own car. Beyond this, there are a number of other important benefits. We're making it possible for people to reduce their environmental impact by sharing their rides, linking to other transportation like mass transit and bikes and scooters, and encouraging drivers to use fully electric vehicles, a program we pioneered here in Portland. Second, we're opening up transportation opportunities in communities that have been underserved by transit and other for-hire services for decades. And we've seen significant growth in these neighborhoods, as our data here in Oregon has borne out, where we've seen some of our fastest growth in areas like East Portland and Gresham, where there was a need for affordable, convenient access to transportation options. Third, we're working to reduce congestion by partnering with transit and right-sizing trips. This means using a bike instead of a car for quick trips. And as we recently made possible in Denver, linking various personal modes of travel with mass transit. You can now pay in the app for mass transit, linking multiple modes all at the same time. Our goal is to make it as easy as possible for people to avoid using their own private car every time they need to go somewhere, whether that alternative is the MAX, the local bus line, or a rideshare alternative. Communities of all sizes across Oregon should be able to leverage these ride-sharing benefits, and a set of basic statewide regulatory requirements is a key element of enabling that to happen. For drivers, it would remove unnecessary barriers and provide a more consistent experience for riders. We've seen the benefits in other states, including in California, where while we launched first in large cities and grew quickly there, a few years later, after we achieved statewide regulatory structure there, we saw a dramatic increase in smaller communities. And that because the statewide system enables drivers to be able to respond without jumping through unnecessary regulatory hoops, and really does open the benefits of this technology to communities across the state.
Thank you.
This bill is an important.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for. But if you have something in writing that's not yet submitted, we'd be happy to read it.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Rose Feliciano. I'm with Internet Association. Internet Association represents more than 40 of the world's leading internet company and advances public policy solutions that foster innovation, economic growth, and empower people through a free and open internet. I am speaking here today in support of House Bill 3023. 3A. I will focus on, I think, what is relevant for the Revenue Committee. This proposal allows for full cost recovery from ODOT. So that is very important, in large part because small jurisdictions don't always have the capacity to do the licensing and the regulatory requirements that would be needed in having TNCs operate in their jurisdictions. By having a statewide framework, this will allow for better consistency for both passengers and drivers. Not only can you take someone to a doctor's appointment, but that person can get a ride home and the driver can pick up another ride in that separate jurisdiction. I think it's very important that this does provide for that consistency, and having the statewide licensing will make it a better transportation system that will feed into all the other transit and taxi and for hire options as well. So with that, I will wrap it up. Thank you very much.
For your testimony. Can I just say one brief, they don't all need to answer it. It's just my broadest issue about with these guys in particular. As the advocate?
In the form of a debate or a question?
No, no, I just kind of a, here's my biggest concern of what I understand of their position on this versus other concerns, which is, thank you for all of your testimony. I continue to hear from, the issue being that this particular approach at this creates a ceiling rather than a floor. It's one thing to say states across the country have a consistent policy. That is a floor, that statewide insurance, whatever it is, whereas this is a preemption. This is a ceiling. It says you can only get cost recovery and that's it, and it preempts everything else. And that is my, and I know many other cities and organizations, kind of big picture difference of opinion about how this is structured versus how we might structure it. That's all.
Thank you. So if you choose to respond, for example, by contacting the committee or the representative, you can do that. Representative Finley.
I have a question of similar nature. Would you please send me, tell me what the issue is you're trying to fix with this law, with this bill? Because I've not been able to figure that one out yet. So
I'd like to hear more testimony, though, today.
And I know that. So please send that to the committee and we can review that.
Thank you.
Thank you all. The next panel. Please come on up, and whoever gets there first can start talking. It's Nicole, Darren, and Tom, right?
Sure. Good morning. My name is Tom Chamberlain. I'm the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, representing over 300,000 workers across this state. We're in opposition to the bill. We began working with Uber and Lyft drivers in 2015, and over the past 4 years, we've collected data through online and in-person surveys. Working with the City of Portland and Uber and Lyft drivers through the Transportation Fairness Portland campaign, we created a driver's board in the City of Portland. This structure is intended to grant drivers and other impacted community members a structure to address their issues. You've seen driver's boards like this happen in other parts of the country. New York City has a similar driver's board. They increase their minimum wage for drivers to $15 an hour. House Bill 3023A would prohibit that from occurring because we couldn't do this at a local level. The other problem that we're seeing is independent contractors. Not just Lyft, but all platform companies are moving toward more and more to independent contractors, which has an impact on our unemployment insurance, workers' compensation insurance, and really puts all the responsibility on the back of the drivers. We have a 2015 advisory opinion from Boley stating that Uber drivers are not independent contractors. Listed in Lyft's IPO is a pending unemployment insurance claim before the Oregon Employment Department. This bill would preempt that decision from occurring. Look, we understand that rural Oregon needs to have some type of ride share, and major metropolitan cities as well. But We think there's a better way to do it. We think the way to do it is to allow cities to opt out of this statewide regulatory process. In other words, have sort of a tour better than scenario where local jurisdictions could improve their programs. Thank you.
Thank you. Members of the committee, Chair Nathanson, my name is Darren Campbell. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Radio Cab Company. Radio Cab Company was created in 1946. We've been around the block a few times, especially in regards to policy making and decisions over the many years. I wanted to speak more towards the process of what this bill, how this bill came to fruition, or its opposing bill as well. During the interim, there was a group of stakeholders from all aspects involved in this type of policy being created. We met multiple times through the help of Representative Holvey and his organizational skills to make sure everybody was involved. Through that process, about halfway through, I believe, Uber and Lyft both decided to stop coming to those policy meetings. Created this bill 3023. It's a Lyft specific written bill with Uber support. It's got no help from the rest of the stakeholders involved. And from the taxi perspective, we've said from the very beginning, treat us fairly and treat us equally. And this does absolutely nothing to do that. It completely removes the two types of players in the same industry who do the exact same job. We drive people from point A to point B. We make sure people get home safely after they've been drinking. We make sure people get to their appointments on time. And to say that we're different and then create a whole statewide regulatory framework, and the biggest issue that we see with this is excluding local jurisdictional control, such as the City of Portland or City of Eugene or Medford or Bend or Salem, who already have a regulatory framework in place and are currently regulating this industry, we feel is wrong. So I know that people from our group have sent in plenty of information for you all to review.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Nicole Sharon. I am an equity policy manager for the City of Portland, and I am the author of the WAVE regulations for Portland. Before I launch into why you should not support HB 3023, I want to give you guys a little secret, and it's the word that we in the disability community call able-bodied people, and that word is TAB, and it stands for temporarily able-bodied. And I want you to think about that, why I tell you why you should not deregulate the cities from having control over private for hire transportation. When we created the WAVE program, and I want to say we're still in the middle of creating it, we did things that no other city in the nation was doing. And we did that because we have someone, me, at the city who has that lived experience who could say, we need to make sure that accessible transportation is included. We also have a program at the city that does outreach to the disability community. I did a little Googling at ODOT to see what kind of disability programming they have. They don't have any. They have a civil rights program. And compliance, it's not equity. It's not the same thing. We have a unique ability at the city to monitor this program, to regulate the program, and to tweak the program as it goes along. I have very big concerns that if this should shift to a statewide regulatory process, all of that will be lost. So I ask you, when you go back in your chambers to make your decision, to think about the fact that you or someone you love is temporarily able-bodied. And do you want programming like this that would ensure accessible transportation for you with the same parity among taxis and private for hire? Do you want that to be buried in state bureaucracy, or do you want it to be regulated at a local level?
Thank you.
Thank you all for speaking.
I'm going to take two more people. We're going to push it a little bit. If you can stay, thank you. If you can't, there are at least a couple of us who are going to stay to hear two more people. First, I'd like to hear from Sherry Moore. And after Sherry, we're going to hear from Maria Hernandez. And then after that, I'll explain what will happen next.
Thank you very much for taking my testimony. My name is Sherry Moore. I'm a retired teacher, and I've served on the Springfield City Council since November of 2010. Thank you, Nancy. I understand and appreciate the importance of citizen input in the legislative process. I understand the importance of local control, but I also believe that many circumstances dictate uniformity in state laws, and I believe this is one of them. I'm testifying today as a private citizen. Springfield has an IGA with Eugene, who licenses public passenger vehicle services in the region. Therefore, even though we as a city may have made the decision sooner in Springfield, we had to wait for Eugene to finally make the decision to allow rideshare this last September. Since I wanted to know about the rideshare licensing process, I decided to apply. And although I thought I might be rejected at any point along the process, I soon found myself being photographed and paying the $65 fee. I am a proud Lyft driver. I'm a very busy person, and thus far I've given less than 50 rides. Obviously, I'm not doing it as a source of income. My son, however, has recently changed careers and is pursuing opportunities throughout the state to stage manage theatrical productions. He has downtime between engagements, and Lyft driving is a great source of supplemental income while he's in Eugene. But as I said, he finds himself in other areas of the state. Most recently, he spent 3 weeks in Bend. He would have loved to have the opportunity to drive for Lyft while there, but his Eugene certification didn't apply in Bend. How great it would have been if he'd had state certification and could drive in any community in Oregon. He has submitted written testimony to this committee. Greg Hopper Moore is his name. As a city councilor, I chair the LTD Strategic Planning Committee. I don't speak for them, but I'm aware of discussions we've had on how we might incorporate ride sharing in our overall and expanded coverage plans throughout rural area. Some of the communities are outside the Eugene Springfield rideshare certification area. Since the state already licenses autos and drivers in a safe and fair way, it makes sense to me that the state could establish uniform regulations that would make it possible for small communities to participate in the sharing community. Thank you very much for taking my testimony.
Thank you. Final speaker for this morning.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Finley, Vice Chair Marsh, and members of the House Committee on Revenue. For the record, my name is Maria Hernandez Segoviano, Policy and Advocacy Manager at Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. We appreciate the hard work and really all the work that has gone into the amendments in trying to figure out what a statewide framework for TNCs could look like. However, House Bill 3023, for the many reasons I have already stated before me, is a bill that undermines meaningful public engagement, gives industries such as Lyft and Uber the ability to continue to ignore labor regulations, and it limits cities from undertaking bolder leadership, hence a ceiling and not a floor. On behalf of our membership, who are transit riders, low-income people, people of color, youth, individuals with disabilities, and more, we urge you to not support House Bill 3023A out of the House and not pass it out of House Revenue Committee. House Bill 3023A gives TNCs the power to put profit over people. TNC trips have continued to reshape the transportation landscape, especially impacted transit ridership, traffic congestion, work labor standards, mobility, and overall our ability to access better and more environmentally friendly options such as public transportation, walking, and biking investments. While House Bill 3023 does not fully limit jurisdictions in creating policies when it comes to traffic and public safety, it still has unintended consequences, negatively impacted the growing congestion, the safety, and social equity for people who live and travel in Oregon cities. Nationally, we have seen the growing impact of TNCs, which have expanded rapidly and appear to continue to contribute to the increasing congestion and declining safety conditions. One of the most disturbing impacts of the growth of TNCs is that it appears to be the part of the explanation for the reversal since 2010 of the decades-long trend of decreasing traffic fatalities in the U.S., with the recent study estimating that the growth of the industry can explain up to 2-4% increase in fatal accidents. The proliferation of these services has cannibalized the share of trips that will otherwise have used public transit, the one best way to reduce the environmental impact of transportation other than bicycling and walking. A recent University of Kentucky study found that the entry of TNCs into our urban market causes or bus ridership to decrease 1.7% a year, and rail transit ridership to decrease 1.3%, and that effect is cumulative. There's a lot more to my testimony, but overall, there's a lot of impact that TNCs have contributed to our certain state, and I'll definitely submit this into record. Thank you so much for your support, and we really hope that you don't pass this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. And thank you, everyone else, for being patient and considerate during our public hearings this morning on different topics. I will continue this public hearing tomorrow for those of you who are able to return. Many of you who I saw signed up to testify, I see that you have already submitted written testimony. I've read some of it already. Perhaps other members of the committee have already read it, and we certainly have it available. But if you would like to come back and speak tomorrow, we're going to try to make it available. Tomorrow was already a full day. We have three public hearings, which are considered, I believe, not to be quite as substantive or controversial or garnering as much interest as this topic. But we do have three other public hearings and one work session tomorrow. We start at 8 a.m., not 8:30. So be here early. We need to get our work done. So thank you again for being here. I am continuing carrying over the public hearing on this bill. Okay. House Bill 3023A and on House Bill 2456A, we're carrying that over. That concludes everything that was on our schedule today. We are adjourned.